Welcome to the Two Industry Podcast, your podcast about stocks and everything business. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only and should not be considered as financial advice. We're doing a special podcast this week because this is our first live in-person recording. Right across the table from Tom. Usually we do this, you know, online, but now I can look right in his face. And in this week's podcast, we're getting into the company Snowflake and we're doing a little overview of the Magnificent Seven. That being said, Tom, what have you been up to this week?
I'd like to first highlight to the viewers how weird it is to sit across from you and talk about this, because normally we do this online. We've done this a couple times now, and you kind of just look at your Word document and I have you on in Teams in the background, but now I have to, like, there's so much more honesty to it now. But it's fun doing it in person. No, my week has been good. I feel like the same thing as last time, just been busy with work, but been doing quite a bit of reading about stocks and the news and yeah, like we said, you're over, so we've been talking a lot. We have some good ideas for stuff we're going to do going forward, so feeling pretty good about today.
Nice, yeah, nice.
So you mentioned we're going to talk about Snowflake, Magnificent
Yep.
Seven.
Yeah.
Should we just go dive into the first topic?
You want to go ahead and go right into industry? And
give me that snow.
Okay, Snowflake, the United States-based company. It's into data. They all do all kinds of stuff with data. Let's just explain this company and its business model first. They're a company that works mainly with other companies, and it uses their, like, existing IT infrastructure and databases and stuff and aggregates it and gives them all kinds of tools to do analysis on it. So all these companies have these old, huge databases of, like, user data and stuff, and usually it's in all kinds of different places, and hiring, like, database experts to get this all together for every single company is a big headache. So that's what this company makes easier. You know, they pull everything in house, and all you have to do is, like, sign up. And so that's the basic business model.
I think at the moment, obviously the whole data thing, kind of linked to AI, you see these types of companies getting a lot more popular. But I think you kind of nailed it there, that what they do is they get all these different formats of data that might be stored in different places, Amazon Web Services, Google Cloud, or what have you, and standardizes it in a way that makes the data usable to put into different, like, models or do things with that data. So I think from that perspective, where you see more and more data being created, it's a very interesting company. I think the one thing that kind of jumped out at me initially, and the reason, because you brought it up the other day, the reason why I was like, hey, that might be a good idea, is because the old man himself invested in it. And
Warren Buffett, he's talking about Warren Buffett here.
Warren Buffett, the old man himself. So anytime you see a stock that he owns, it's already like, okay, there's probably a certain level, fundamental level that this company has that probably makes it, you know, it gives it an extra verification. Like, okay, he's bought it, so it's probably got something in there.
I don't know. Buffett also makes mistakes.
Obviously.
And in some of his companies that he goes into with, like, preferred stock and all kinds of downside protections. So it's not as easy for an investor to, you know, copy Buffett perfectly. But
it's a filter.
It's a little seal of approval. It's not worthless, probably.
Because that's also the thing about this company. It's interesting, but it's not a Buffett company necessarily.
No. Now, I think what Buffett, he has done something which he never does, is that he invested in this company's IPO. I think before this company, it was, like, I don't know, 20 years since he last invested in an IPO or something. Yeah. A really long time ago. But what I think he really likes about this company is that it has all the markers of becoming, like, a future company with a big moat. Right. Because once companies start using Snowflake services to aggregate their data and stuff, it creates money for them. Like, they get all these insights from their own data using Snowflake's products. And, you know, it ties them to Snowflake and their services. And Snowflake, you know, can keep improving their analytics tools and stuff, and they're now more and more integrating AI into their products. Also with their brand spanking new CEO coming from the AI part of the company, which I think is quite interesting. Could be a little, you know, opportunistic, you know, oh, AI is all in the news, let's get an AI CEO, yeah, you know.
I think we were watching a little segment of Jim Cramer on the TV earlier.
Which is always a bad idea.
Yeah, then so at the beginning of the show, Cass prefaced this whole show by saying, do not take this as financial advice. And the fact that we're bringing up Cramer now and saying, oh, we saw something on his show, is all the more reason not to listen to us.
But that being said, don't listen to Cramer.
No. So when we're saying buy Snowflake and he's saying buy Snowflake, then you should probably short it. But that being said,
I'm not saying you should buy it. Just make your own decision.
Make your own decisions. That being said, the AI thing is probably an important step, in that they hired someone from within, someone who can, really play off that theme. I think is a good advantage.
Yeah. And some tasty insider buying. You know, this new CEO immediately bought $5 million worth of stock in the company.
I think that you know, for the people listening, that's always a good sign. You know, the stock has been going down. If you just look at, obviously, the stock price itself is not your main reason to buy or sell something, but it is a little bit of a catalyst, at least for me. When I see a stock go down quite a bit, it's a moment, especially for these type of companies, to turn your head around the corner and be like, okay, what's going on here? So the fact that the price is going down, coupled with the fact that this new CEO is buying stock, probably shows a degree of certainty in the company's future. So always a good thing when that happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, you know, the comparison with a company like Palantir is like quite obvious, but there's a few differences there. Maybe you should go into that a little bit.
Yeah, it's obviously it's a bit outside my area of expertise, but from what I understand, Snowflake is far more in the business of standardizing the data that you have, being able to kind of present it on a silver platter and be like, okay, here's everything, go do with it what you want. And Palantir, from what I understand, is a bit more proprietary. So they kind of put a gate around it to force you to stay with Palantir. That's the negative part. But the positive part is that they really use that data to improve and drive business improvements. And from what I understand from Snowflake, that's less the case.
Yeah, Snowflake really works with your existing data partners. So if you have Oracle databases, or like you said, Amazon databases or whatever, they work with that, while Palantir really transitions you over to a new Palantir database. And the power in Palantir is that they're willing to do that with relatively modern databases. But I think they also have quite a lot of government contracts at Palantir. They do that with like databases from the 60s or whatever that are basically, with regards to modern technology, those days of databases are useless. Palantir makes them useful, puts them on their new platforms, which is a lot of work to really transition that data. And Snowflake works a little bit differently from there. But that's also where you get into another interesting thing here, which what Snowflake does is they really focus on their sales department. There's not many like software companies that have this many sales representatives, and they really like target the CFOs and the IT directors of companies to get into that level. And at first, you know, convince them to spend a little bit of their IT budgets on Snowflake's products. And what you can tell with Snowflake is once they're in the door, existing customers start spending more and more money with Snowflake. So, for example, their revenue growth is insane. They 10x their revenue in 4 years. But also their current customers, the average rate that a current customer spends with Snowflake next year is over 130%. Yeah. So the customer retention is over 100%. You don't see that much. And that's a thing where usually if a company is a lot of like marketing spend, a lot of sales reps, it's usually because they tend to lose revenue over time. Because once they offer products, you know, people use them or companies use them for a bit and like, oh, okay, thanks, I got it now. And they don't return to the company. And so these type of companies, they hire more and more sales reps to get more and more revenue, but it's not sustainable. And that's something you can really tell, that this is like revenue that builds on top of each other, you know?
Yeah, what I think that there, when you look at the income statement, the first thing you see is, you know, the negative profit number. And the main reason for that is partly stock-based comp, which I think we'll get into a bit more, but also what seems to be not over-hiring, but a high amount of hiring in their marketing, their R&D departments, whatever you want to call it. And I think that's partly explains why the retention rate is so high, is because they put so much effort into, I'm going to call it their sales department, getting people out there, getting people to stay with Snowflake.
Mm-hmm.
The risk there is, obviously, as they keep growing much faster than they're spending on their sales department, if they keep growing, it's okay. If it stagnates,
yeah, that's,
it's obviously not that's as rough. Okay. And I think what I read a lot online when doing research is that the market is somewhat worried about not a stagnating revenue growth, but the acceleration of revenue growth is going down. So they were growing 100%, 80%, 60, 40, 30.
Yeah.
I think they're now in their high 30s. If that massively slows down and you're still spending a lot on the sales department, then there's a risk
to the profitability in the future. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, because currently, like, sales and R&D is a big part of their expenses, and they do a lot of stock-based comp to pay their employees, which you can really tell in the figures. But yeah, I feel like the revenue growth will be there, but it's indeed the long term, because you can tell by the yearly figures year to year that they're getting more financially efficient. You know, they're getting to these economies of scale where it really makes sense for them to hire the individual data analysts and not the companies that they serve. Everyone hire their own. You can really start seeing the efficiencies. But yeah, it needs to grow more, and the efficiencies needs to still increase. So
it needs to grow more, but also we obviously did a little bit of, let's say, napkin math, a little DCF, see where we are. And it's, you know, obviously you have to make quite some assumptions on profit margin or PE ratios and whatnot, but it's not crazy. You know, they still have to grow in the trend of 5 to 6 times their current revenue. And the company of this size, it's, for me, the way I look at their business model, what they're doing now, how they've grown, it's not completely outside the realm of possibility. So in that sense, given the fact that they have already grown so much and don't have to grow as much to, in my opinion, fulfill the current valuation, is somewhat promising. I think on top of that, if we look at things that are going very well, we look at investors, and you hear a lot on TV and you read a lot about PE ratios. If you look at their cash flow, their free cash flow, that's actually quite good. And the main reason that I think we could find why that was positive and the income was negative was because of those stock-based compensation points, spending on R&D. But the fact that the fundamental points show that the business is able to generate money is a very good sign. And I think if I had to choose, there's a couple more things we can get into that look good as well, but the fact that they are able to generate free cash flow.
Yeah, and the one important thing is that you can see it improving. Like, you see over time that the profitability is increasing, and even if you take the stock-based compensation into account, they've already had quarters where, even if you include the stock-based compensation, they would have still made money from their operations. So you can really tell that this company is moving towards actually being profitable and actually raking in money. And if you combine that with their growth history, but also their growth trajectory, and you just look at, you know, for example, their gross margin, I think they're above 60% growth margin.
Like, it's insane.
There's a lot of promise here. And like Tom said, this isn't a huge company yet. This isn't a Google yet, which is worth more than $1 trillion, you know. This is a little over $50 billion company. A company like Google has $111 billion in cash. They could just buy this company outright if they like, you know, where it's going. So, yeah, the growth, while it's a high rate of growth, it's not out of the ballpark, you know.
No, it's also in one of those industries that's at the moment very attractive. And the high gross margin, the ability to generate cash flow from the business is positive. And I think on top of that, one thing that also, you know, nails it for me is just the low debt.
Mm.
This company has so much cash on hand and has zero
long-term debt.
And it just shows that they're able, Because that's also the thing. If they did have a lot of debt, that could explain how they're able to grow the business in as fast of a pace that they can or that they are now. And the fact that they're able to do that without taking on a huge amount of debt is good.
Yeah.
But stock-based compensation is another way in which they're able to earn some money via. But
yeah,
even though stock-based comp in its absolute numbers is still going up, as a percentage of the current shares outstanding, it is getting better. So one big thesis for me with this stock, and I don't know if the listeners at home can tell, but we're relatively positive about this company, not a financial advice. I think they're going to be able to slow down the issuing of shares. And if we really see that pull through, I think I'm going to get even more positive about this because that's a big factor. You do dilute
the existing investor.
Existing investor, and that's a bit of a negative thing there.
I think another asterisk and another nuance is that their products, their services, to really help out these companies with big data sets and all over the place, is that there are only so many companies with like these huge data sets, so they only have so many customers.
Yeah.
Possible customers. You can tell that they have been able to reach, quite a lot of these big companies, and it's also kind of a seal of approval that all these big companies use their products.
I saw Disney, JetBlue, just big. I don't necessarily know S&P 500, but these types of companies.
Electronic Arts, a bunch of big companies that are their clients. So that's also a seal of approval, and it's maybe from the looks of things, they've really focused on U.S. companies. So it's probably also some big revenues out there waiting in like European companies or South American companies or whatever.
I think I saw like 80% of all the revenue comes from the US. So indeed there's opportunity everywhere. And in that sense, their business model, simplifying data for lack of a better term, does not discriminate on what type of industry you're in, if you're growing, yes or no. Everyone, and maybe even old European industrial companies would benefit more than an Electronic Arts, which is a company you would think would be modern enough and technologically savvy enough to already be quite far with this. But
even an Electronic Arts, so apparently really profits from using Snowflake services. And even them, yes, they're a big company, but apparently even they have like a lot of like random databases all over the place, and pulling them all together and being able to really, lay connections and get into it, like, with, I don't know, FIFA, when do people buy loot boxes or whatever, you can figure it out with Snowflake, and you can just tell that it makes them money.
Yeah, well, one other thing, bringing it back to, what other companies could be in, could be competitors. We've talked about Palantir a bit. Databricks, there's a couple of others, but the one thing I really like about Snowflake, you're looking more at the qualitative aspect of it, is that they're quite focused on one thing, and I think if they lean into that and use different things like AI to really help simplify the data that's given to them, I think is positive.
Yeah, and it's also, you could have a lot of companies that do a similar thing. Where I think Palantir is much of an all-encompassing solution. It's like going to Apple and getting your entire ecosystem from Apple, your laptop, your phone. While Snowflake is much more, I don't care what device you have, but we'll work with you.
Yeah.
And so that's the comparison with Palantir. But if you look at other companies that do a similar thing, what shouldn't be underestimated is their sales team. Because they already have a seat at the table. They're already trusted, they're already in there. I think that's one also risk with expanding to foreign markets. They don't have their sales network set up there.
Right.
So that could be a little bit of a challenge, a little bit of an increased spend. But over time, you can just tell that customers stick with them and they spend money with them. Yeah, ultimately, that's all you're going to need to see.
So to summarize, I think we've listed all the positive parts of it. The two negatives are stock-based comp, and their heavy reliance on their sales apparatus. And they are able to capture a lot of revenue with that current sales apparatus in the United States. If they were to expand abroad, it would cost even more money possibly hitting, you know, various financial metrics. And if they do lighten that sales, R&D, whatever part of it, are they able to maintain the same retention rate that we mentioned before? I think those, for me, are two. So stock-based comp, you can follow quarter to quarter quite well. And if that stabilizes off, I have, you know, in that sense, I feel pretty good about it.
And it's also
it's the sales part for me. It's that large part of that business. How is that going to look?
Yeah, but it's also the revenue. If they, because with the current revenue levels and their current cost levels, it's not there yet. They still need to improve. So either they need over time, if they start stagnating from now on, which I don't expect, but let's say they do stagnate in terms of revenue, they are going to need to decrease costs. But it's more likely that they are growing revenue and that gets the total cost under control, because revenue is growing faster than these costs are. And yeah, those are basically the risk. I think you detailed it quite well. But yeah, with these precious little snowflakes, I think there's some money to be made, don't you think?
Yeah, I think so too. I think this, I don't know, I'm just getting a certain phrasing, a certain jingle in my head.
To
industry, old C. All right, next segment for this this little podcast. I don't know if you've ever heard of this before. It's this term called the Magnificent Seven. Ever heard this one?
Tell me more, Tom.
So what they've basically done is they've given a name to this group of stocks. It's a couple of the biggest stocks in the stock. I don't know if you've heard about them, but they've grouped them together and they've given them this name. So little company, Apple.
What?
Apple.
A fruit?
Yeah, yeah. So, so you know, you have pears.
Yeah.
Apple.
All right.
Microsoft, Amazon, Alphabet, Nvidia, Meta, and Tesla.
So a few small companies.
Just a couple. I think it's around 5% of the S&P 500.
Oh, like,
so it's nothing. It's nothing. So I don't get why people make such a big deal out of this, but apparently you read a lot about it. So no, all kidding aside, I think it's if you look at the past year, if you look at how the market has outperformed over the past couple of years, it's all been about these seven stocks. Everything is all about the headlines are dominated by a couple of these names. And I think especially the past couple of months, little semiconductor company called Nvidia has popped up a lot, outperformed the market a little bit, I think, but done pretty well. And it's all the craze at the moment. So they've contributed such a large part to the general outperformance compared to the other companies in the S&P 500 that these just get talked about constantly.
Yeah, I think without the Magnificent Seven, the S&P wouldn't have gained anything last year or something like that, or something very little. I remember seeing some headlines like last year, like without the Magnificent Seven, you know, this would have been a whole different year investing wise.
So I think that's looking back. If you look now and forward, because of this such heavy outperformance, the performance of the benchmarks, you know, the S&P 500, NASDAQ, are so reliant on the performance of these stocks. And I think especially in the past, it's been a lot about these stocks. And the worry in the market is if they start, you know, flattening out or underperforming, what's going to happen to the benchmark? So because people are so focused on these indices, and people hold a lot of these indices in their retirement accounts, if these companies don't do as well, you know, these benchmarks will not do as well, and people who are stock pickers will probably outperform. So the question I think that on everyone's mind, and I think what we want to get into in this segment, is realizing, yes, they outperform so massively, but do we want to own these stocks going forward? The risk of owning them is, of course, they've outperformed so much. What kind of trajectory is there still?
You know, doubling a million is much easier than doubling a billion, and doubling a billion is probably easier than doubling a trillion.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And not owning these companies will mean that if they do outperform, that the chance that you outperform the benchmark is obviously a lot lower. So I kind of want to go through them one by one and kind of give your take on, because I think maybe disclaimer to the audience, we do own some of these names. I think if I look at the list, I own two. I think you own one. None at all.
Not yet.
So which one is jumping at you at the moment as the most favorite?
Oh, as a favorite, not as the worst.
Which one? I think we both know which one's the worst.
The worst one's not that easy. I'd say it's probably Tesla right now.
Yeah, Tesla. Why is it the worst for you?
It's probably the worst because Tesla has been valued for a long time as a tech company and has really struggled a little bit with, is it a tech company or is it a car manufacturer? And the margins and the valuations and everything is just so different if you're a quick growing tech company or if you're a car manufacturer. And you can see this tension in this stock for a while now. It's also probably one of the reasons why it has underperformed the last, basically since the COVID boom, when Tesla stock went through the roof. And then the valuation was really ridiculous. Let's be honest here. It went up to heights where it was just worth too much.
But there were more stocks that were overvalued. I think that's different to now.
But this one, it was kind of next level. It's that tension where long term, are they going to be able to grow like a tech company in terms of like margins, in terms of revenue growth? Like, are they really going to be able to do this? Then it's going to be a great company, but the risk is still in there that it's going to be just a car company in the long term. And if it's going to be just a car company in the long term, all these valuation metrics are just going to be so much lower, and you could really use your shirt still on this stock, even though it's underperformed for quite a bit.
I think for me with Tesla, and it's one of those stocks that everyone in the canteen talks about, right? Mm. Compared to some of these other names that are a bit less known, everyone talks about Tesla. Obviously, the company is good. The cars are pretty cool. So that side of it, I get. The argument I make with a lot of my friends is the car side of the business is good, and there's a certain tangible value and future value that you can assign to those cars. And you could even argue that they're going to keep growing going forward because they make good products. I think what's valued in the market is indeed the whole, you call it rightfully, the tech side of it. Think the data that they gather for their full self-driving stuff on the one hand. On the other hand, it's the opportunity of the robo-taxi. So self-driving allows these cars to go out into public themselves, and you can kind of pay for it as you go. And when they're idle, they go charge themselves and they come back to you. The difficulty for me is when I'm trying to value a company going forward is I do not know when this is going to happen. I think Elon Musk has been saying the FSD thing has been coming for 10 years. And if it happens, what is the material impact on revenue going forward and profit, what have you? I don't know. And
yeah, it's also going to be a thing. Like, is this going to be a thing everywhere at the same time as well? Because, full self-driving, we've Elon has been going on about for years. It's probably quite hard, let's be honest here. Yeah. And it's been taking years to research all this stuff and
regulation
as well. But then the question also becomes like, at some point, I can imagine that Tesla is in the US, and also I think one of the big factory of theirs is in California. Like, I can imagine in California, you could figure it out over time. It's always sunny. There's never like bad conditions.
Big roads.
But once you get to like these more northern parts of the country, for example, where there's a lot more rain or where there's snow, all these factors could mess with the sensors of the car. Like, robo-taxi could be a thing in California, but maybe not in Minnesota or whatever. Like,
I think the best way, asterisks. If I'm listening to us here, there is opportunity, and they may be one of the companies that's best position to take advantage of these kind of mega trends going forward. The difficulty is it's uncertain when, how much, if, and the stock is priced for not super perfection like it was last year or the year before, but still priced for perfection, which makes this one for me out of the seven the most, let's say, unattractive.
But there are opportunities here. For example, talk out of the industry is that the the heating solution that is in the Tesla cars is really good.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing here is the heating solution in modern electric cars is the same heating solution as in modern homes, for namely a heat pump, just an advanced AC unit. Now, a possible business segment for Tesla could be offering those heat pumps for homes. Only, again, you get into the same thing with the cars. Yes, that is a promising business segment for them, but it is, again, a business segment with different margins in the tech sector. And yeah, so if you look at their tech, that's where all the promise lies. But meanwhile, there's also increasingly, you know, worse news coming out about their bread and butter, their cars. Like competition from EV makers from China is really picking up. And then you read the other week in the news, like, yeah, the Model 2, the more affordable version of the Model 3 Tesla is by the looks of things, is postponed further into the future. You know, all these things, yeah, this is where they need to make their money. As long as all these, you know, future high-flying tech solutions are not out there.
Also, just to close off Tesla here, I don't see the Cybertruck. As in the, you read and hear a lot of pundits saying that this is the next, you know, big thing, and they're going to ramp this. And I'm just like, it's so expensive and it's so, pie in the sky kind of thing. I don't think that's where it's going to come from either. So it's a really cool company. They have a lot of cool stuff, but I find it really hard to value what's in the pipeline. And you can play devil's advocate, because we're obviously smashing this thing down. If one thing does hit,
it's going to hit hard.
It's going to hit big. Yeah. So they have all these bets coming out. I don't know. If you compare to the other ones, least certain about this one.
Yeah, this one is up to you.
This one's up to me. I'm not going to get
this. Up to the listener.
Oh, up to the listener.
But what really jumps out at me from the stocks, like which one I like best, is probably Google.
Yeah.
They've been having some bad news, you know, recently with their spectacular AI product. You know, it's a bit of a euphemism there. but their price compared to the other Magnificent Seven here, it's quite depressed. Even though they're still, you know, a fairly quickly growing company, you know.
A quickly growing company. And one thing I kind of keep in the back of my mind, what are the two largest search engines in the world?
Google and, YouTube.
Yeah.
Oh, if you classify it as a separate search engine.
I use YouTube as a search engine sometimes. When I'm looking up how to do something, I'll sometimes go to YouTube first rather than Google.
I'm really good at pissing off my girlfriend when she's like, you don't know how to do this. I'm like, yeah, me and YouTube definitely know how to do this.
My best friend, YouTube. No, but obviously still a fast-growing company. I think the main reason why it's been a bit depressed is, like you said, the whole AI thing and the market's all into that kind of hype. One small asterisk there. There's reports out that Apple might use their AI model in their next iPhones.
Well, the stock has been, you know, recovering quite a bit in the last month or so.
Yeah, but I think one big thing here is the moat. They have such big properties in Google Search, Android, YouTube, Google Cloud. They have all these avenues that they can still pursue in order to get growth.
Yeah, I think a bit of a worry out there in the markets as well is that there's a fear that stuff like ChatGPT is going to influence the search engine game. Like, there's a worry that people are going to ask ChatGPT or Microsoft Copilot or, you know, whatever for search suggestions instead of using Google. But so far, a bit, but we haven't really seen.
I think the best way for me to
Google search.
Yeah, exactly. It's. I see the threat. I can understand where they're coming from, but I don't think we're anywhere close. And now I'm gonna say something that people are gonna hammer me on again in the future. But we're not close to seeing that materialize quite yet. One, because it's ChatGPT is not there yet, or Copilot's not there yet, and two, no one's going to stop using Google Search anytime soon.
Yeah, and the thing is as well, Google's making their own AI. Yes, they're, you know, they're having some struggles with it, but they are definitely going to integrate AI into their own search product. So maybe AI will replace old-fashioned search in some way, but even if that's the case, it's another leap to think that, okay, so then it would mean that people will use something other than Google. And then you get into also the mode, like you said at the beginning, where the Google search engine product is also integrated with so many of their other products. Like ChatGPT, if that's going to be the search thing, it's still going to refer to YouTube videos. You know, it's still going to refer you to, I don't know, Google Docs or whatever. Yeah. Like this is still going to be a thing.
Yeah, I mean, the revenue streams for Google are plentiful enough that my concern on the whole AI thing, if that were to materialize, is fairly minimal. So I think the market has overreacted a little bit to that AI thing, because that's the theme in the market at the moment, maybe less so recently, but especially the past couple of months. So I'm still quite optimistic about Google's future.
All right. Well, which other company of the Magnificent Seven would you like to point out, Tom?
Depends what perspective you ask me from. I own one of these other companies, not financial advice, but Meta has been is obviously quite overvalued at the moment if you look at their current PE. But if there's one thing that Meta has shown is that, you know, yes, they had their whole like cost crisis in 2022, which caused their stock to dip. They overhired, but their business model has so much like fat on the bone that they're able to really press out a lot of earnings, a lot of cash flow out of their business model. So Meta maybe less interesting now, but if you look at where the stock has come from and how much growth they've been able to post in their earnings, obviously there's a question of sustainability, there's a degree of political risk maybe there, but Meta's been a really interesting one for me in the past couple of years. Mm. What do you think about Meta?
Well, yeah, you referenced the 2022 dip. I think from the company side, you said a lot of good things, but from the perspective of the stock price, this 2022 dip is nowhere to be seen. Like this stock has more than fully recovered from this dip and has gotten to a point where I think it's starting to edge towards the, you know, quite expensive side of things. And then the question is going to be, okay, it is this company with, you know, the ability to really, you know, pull in some cash. How is this company and what are their future prospects if you compare it to a Google, if you compare it to a Microsoft, if you compare it to an Apple? Like, is this a company, especially you'd have to take that in mind all the time, at this valuation, how is the comparison to these other players?
I think Meta, if you look at amount of users in the world and how often they use their platforms, is still quite good. Obviously, they have properties such as Facebook, they have Instagram, they have WhatsApp. Also growing, not in China, but in the rest of the developing world. I think that's still a positive. I think if you look at the amount of money that they get per user, they have a certain metric that they use for it. I don't exactly know what it's called, but obviously in the US, that's very high. They get a lot of money on their advertising, but in developing countries, that's still quite low. So I think while the user growth may taper off over time, I think there's still a lot of money to squeeze out of the current business model. And you see that evidenced by the fact that Zuckerberg is still investing a lot in the metaverse. Maybe not the most interesting thing to spend, I think, $10 billion a year on. I don't exactly know what the number is, but billions of dollars a year. Not a lot of innovation, maybe, from a technological perspective. Maybe the company itself is not as interesting as it used to be, but I think there's still some earnings to press out of the current business model. The question is in how far that's still possible with the current valuation.
You're basically predicting a Tim Cook effect. So, after Steve Jobs, Tim Cook took over Apple, talking about Apple, and even though you could say that innovation wasn't as, you know, much of an item ever since Steve Jobs, Tim Cook has really been able to make that company perform financially like top level for much longer than people expected, just because there was so much more to be gained from their current business model. Maybe that's what happens with Facebook as well, that, you know, their first really big innovative era of Facebook could be slowly coming to an end. It depends on what happens to things like the metaverse, but that, you know, there's still quite a bit of financial performance here to still improve.
I think one other thing that, you know, we often talk about as well, maybe not directly related to the Mag 7, but I bought this company at a while back, and it's outperformed and done so well so long, is you see that in your portfolio, and that kind of wants you to keep hold of it as well. It's that psychological effect coupled with the fact that, it's just... It's still an interesting company. It's something you've researched. It's something you look into, and you still keep having faith in it. I think there's a little bit of sunken cost there as well, which is always a thing with stocks. But if you compare it to Tesla, it's a lot more interesting to me.
Mm.
If you compare it to Alphabet, it's maybe less. I'm not buying this stock anymore.
No. Maybe you should take some gains, man.
Maybe I should take some gains. Let's see. What's I think those, for me, are the three most interesting stories, things I'm looking at, things I follow a little bit. Obviously, what I own, and Tesla a bit because it's Tesla.
Mm.
What's the next one that...
I mean, the rest is not as exciting either from a company perspective or a stock price perspective.
Let's take a little halftime report. We have Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, and Nvidia left. Those four out of the seven. Which one of the two are... the most interesting, and which one of the two are the least interesting?
So of the four, you mean?
Yeah. So which two?
Well, you got to put Nvidia up there on the interesting side, and Microsoft on the interesting
really?
Side.
Really, I think Amazon is more interesting. No, I think we can dive into Amazon. Why? What's with Amazon?
I think it's still, you know, what they're known for with their e-commerce platform versus where they make their money now is very different. Like, their money is now made on their Amazon Web Services, their cloud products, their database products. While, you know,
yeah, that's true now, but going forward,
I think their sales platform, you know, people are starting more and more to realize that the prices on Amazon are a lot higher than the prices on like an AliExpress or like a Temu, and you know, you get the same product.
But is that Amazon, or is that more of a, let's say, macroeconomic issue?
It could be both, but like I feel like more and more consumers, depending on the product that they buy there, are going to figure out like, yeah, I could just like wait a week longer and get it from AliExpress instead of Amazon and save like 80% of the money. Like, I think that side of the business is not as strong. No, I don't. It's maybe it's just that I don't think it's as exciting. The prospects aren't as big. It's if you look at something like the enterprise value over the earnings before interest and taxes, it's at almost 50 for Amazon.
Yeah, but one caveat I have with Amazon is I think that they've invested everything that they've ever earned back into the business. And eventually, if you, you know, invest that kind of money that early on, you can take that money out. The return on invested capital is high. The money that they're able to invest allows them to put that money in an efficient vehicle that over time, that when they decide to turn that switch, which they have done now, they're able to cut costs, fire people. Yeah, that sounds very harsh, but reduce their employee count to a point where you are seeing that cash flow coming back as you're seeing now. Slowly, that cash flow value is going up because they've realized, hey, we've put in a 0% interest rate environment, we've put all this money in. Now the market is turning and saying, hey, we want to get more. We want to see more cash flow. We want to see more profit. And I think Amazon is showing that once they go down that avenue, they're able to find that money and they're able to return that money to shareholders.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, they've invested all this money, yes, indeed, in a low interest rate environment and everything, but they've invested it in things like, indeed, their own ships or their own planes or their own trains. And these are all businesses that historically have not been great. No, so, and it's one thing to assume that Amazon steps into a business, into a market, and they're going to be good, but are they going to really change the fundamentals of all these different businesses?
I think if you look at Amazon.com, the marketplace, I think there's a lot of money to still get out of there. They've created such a big moat for themselves not only because it's the go-to marketplace, but also because they vertically integrated, doing their own shipping, processing of payments, that kind of stuff, you'll realize that there is a lot more potential there. There is a lot of more money to take out there. The problem is, again, kind of similar to what we're talking about with Tesla, I think they are able to do that. I think they're able to do that to a large extent. But kind of linked to the points you made of the fact that planes, trucks and stuff are fairly low margin, the question for me is how much are they able to take out and how much will that translate eventually to the bottom line? So I think they've clearly gone down that avenue. They've clearly shown that there is a lot of value locked up in the business, but how will that translate into earnings and the magnitude of those earnings? I think that's where I struggle with this stock, but I am really certain, if you look at how much they've invested into the business the past couple of years, that there is so much profitability still being able to be found.
Yeah, in general, it's just a great company. But is it a great stock? I don't know. I'm not going to be buying it.
No, me neither.
We still need to do a little bit of Microsoft. Microsoft also just a great company, but right now it's a bit of AI hype.
You know, a bit different to kind of how we discussed it before, but Microsoft used to be like in the gulag. You know, it used to be one of the shittiest stocks in the stock market. If we talk about it a little bit with Meta, but if you see where that company has come from, I think Aramco, we talked about it last week, was still the highest market weight capped company. I think Microsoft is bigger than Apple now.
Could be, yeah.
Yeah, I think they're the largest market capped US company. But Microsoft, I think, is just where it is now because of the whole AI thing.
Yeah.
The ChatGPT stake.
Yeah,
launching a Microsoft Copilot, that's what's caused the stock price to run. Outside the fact that, of course, they have some really good properties in the company themselves.
Yeah, they have a lot of pricing power as well. They can really raise prices still on things like the Office Suite. And yeah, there's a lot of money there. And I think it's also, like you said, the investment into ChatGPT, but also their Microsoft Copilot is one of the first AIs that you can actually like use.
Yeah.
So that's also powerful, but indeed, the stock has run because of the AI thing. And is the company worth the stock price? I don't know.
Yeah, it's difficult. But again, we kind of talked about it with Google going forward. There's still so much that we can bank on. They also have their cloud business. They have Windows. They have still plenty of avenues to pursue in case one of the business models doesn't work out.
True.
But the big risk, if, and I think we're going to say the same with NVIDIA, but if the AI thing kind of, you know, tapers off, goes down, the hype gets less, I think there's a risk for the stock price there. Outside the fact that I think the company is fantastic.
The company is fine. It's just, and over time, if you want to invest into Microsoft for a longer time frame, you're also going to be fine.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's probably a bit rich right now.
Yeah.
That being said, what about Apple?
Apple.
I feel like it's revenue growth seems to be stagnating a little bit. You should never count out Apple.
Exactly. That's the thing that's in the back of my head. We've been, I've had a lot of discussions at home with family and friends about Apple. And there have been multiple times throughout its history where people have kind of doubted it. And they've always been able to find that next thing, that next niche. The question is, and maybe I'm a bit naive, I don't see anything out there anymore that could really be their next product, whether it be the iPhone, you know, things like AirPods, Apple Watches. I think Vision Pro is a little bit, it's a first generation product. We still need to see how it goes. Maybe they'll be able to make more market competitive products. But I don't see it
doesn't seem to be going towards a point where, look, the iPhone is a super mass market product.
Yeah.
Like so many people have an iPhone and so many people could buy an iPhone. With the price point and currently the use case of the Vision Pro, that is severely limited. So they would have to get that product to a place where in terms of price and in terms of functionality, it comes close to the iPhone for it to become the next thing.
I think the big thing for me is it's transition into a hardware company that was focused on how many iPhones and I'm selling per year is it's now transitioning into the installed base. How is Apple able to leverage, almost to a point where you can say Apple doesn't care what phone they sell you. If it's an iPhone 8, an iPhone 10, an iPhone 13, as long as you're using their services.
And I think I that's feel like where, it's not there yet, though.
No, it's not there, but that's what I think it's transitioning into. That's where the gross profit is. That's where the high margins are.
Could be, but that could be, that's like a second Tim Cook effect or something. Really yeah. getting more money out of their existing thing. And I don't know, that's also kind of what they've been trying for the last few years.
One other argument I'm hearing a lot is India. They're going to start producing their phones in India, and India has this weird rule where if you want to sell your product there, you need to be making a significant minority of the product itself in India.
Oh.
And they're building with Foxconn, I think it is, they're building factories there. I mean, it's the biggest country in the world.
How are they going to be in terms of price point? Because India is a much more price-conscious
Yeah, but market. They said the same about China 10 years ago when they were able to leverage. If India grows in the way that certainly the market seems to be predicting, I think there's opportunity to that also in the secondhand market to sell phones there and leverage that whole software thing. I think one other point I want to make with Apple that I think no other consumer discretionary company has, or not to this extent, is the fashionness of it. There's something that this, you know, about the AirPods, about the watch that has, you can see from a distance, oh, those are AirPods. I think Apple still has that.
Yeah, but the thing is with that as well, and that really comes back to the where we started this Apple chat, is the next big thing. They could have the next big thing. You know, they could have another AirPods. But the thing is, the company has grown so huge that even if they do find the next AirPods, the effect on their business is going to be smaller and smaller. The thing is with their business and the size that it has now, the next thing that they find will have to be even bigger than iPhone was, even bigger than AirPods was, to really have that same material impact on the stock.
I think I tend to agree with you. And if you want to buy Apple, and not, again, not saying to the listeners that they should, but if you want to buy Apple, I think it's the thesis should be, how are they better able to leverage their install base? Because they're not going to find that next product that brings the massive bump in revenue unless they come out with a crazy iPhone in September, which I find hard to see. I think the argument to make for Apple is that they are pivoting more towards a software company like Microsoft is and are able to
earn more money. But then let's say, you know, Apple and Google are roughly the same price for their earnings. Which one do you buy?
Google.
Well, I think that says it all.
Yeah, I think Google, but that's because one, Google, you know, can unlock value in the same way we were arguing with Apple. And I think that Google still has growth avenues to pursue, whether it be AI. YouTube is I read somewhere recently that it's profitable or free cash flow positive. There's still more to squeeze there. There's still more low-hanging fruit than with Apple. Let me put it like that.
I think Chromebooks are a massively underrated opportunity for Google.
Really interesting one. Chrome, we're going back to Alphabet now, but Chromebooks are being used more and more places at schools. And the big argument that I'm reading is that people are going to come out of schools having learned how to use Chromebooks and are going to use them in the future as well. And they're going to return to that device because that's what they know.
Yeah, I think I was the one to tell you about this like a few years ago or a year ago. But yeah, I really think that's going to happen. Like if someone who's always used a Chromebook at school, he grows up and he's like, oh, I kind of need a little home laptop to do my taxes, to do this, to do that. Oh, they have a Chromebook at the store. I'll get a Chromebook.
To all the listeners at home, Cass thinks of an example. I'm going to need a laptop to do my taxes. I think that says everything. Normal people get a laptop to watch YouTube videos. I want to do my taxes.
But they can watch YouTube videos on their TV, you know. You're going to get a reason to get a laptop.
True.
You're kind of right.
Yeah. Last company.
Yeah, we haven't talked about NVIDIA yet. What about that?
That company's been insane the past couple.
Yeah, it has been. All right. To industry.
To industry.
Ladies, gents, boys and girls, thank you very, very, very much for listening to another episode of the Two Industry Podcast. I'd also like to thank my co-host, Cass.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Sometimes I gotta give you a little bit of a compliment.
He's just saying this because we're across the table from each other. He would never say this, you know, when we're doing it online.
No, I think a good homework for the listeners at home. Next episode will probably be online again. Check if I am as nice to Cass as I am. No, but I think we had a lot of good discussions. I think starting off with Snowflake, massively interesting company, massively interesting prospect for us going forward. So if that company is going to grow the way that it grows, is it still worth it? I think we've done a really, you know, high level but good in-depth discussion on the Magnificent Seven. I especially think our long discussion on NVIDIA.
Definitely.
You know, how fast it's been growing is just insane. I think the quality and the in-depth analysis we've done, especially on that company, is just really good.
The readers or the listeners are really going to like
it. I feel
that.
Like we should have gone more into detail on the other six, though. I think we spent too much time on NVIDIA.
Definitely, yeah.
But, you know, there's always feedback we can give each other, so that's positive. Now, I'd like to thank everyone for listening, and as we always say, to industry.
To industry!